Why did we go from this to this? Everyone's been complaining about how ugly the modern world looks, including me. They say corporations are greedy, designers are lazy, minimalism destroys beauty, convenience destroyed culture. You've heard all of it. And they're not totally wrong, but they're all blaming the wrong things and they're ignoring the people who quietly decide how almost everything around you is allowed to look. And they're not designers. Here's an example. You're designing a park bench. Simple enough, right? Nope. First, it has to pass accessibility laws or else it won't get built. So the dimensions change to suit that. Then reality hits. Placement. The bench faces the south side of the street, directly in the sun. Those beautiful cast iron armrests will get hot as a frying pan in summer and cold as ice in winter. Then you meet the stakeholders. Senior citizens want a place to sit, but shop owners don't want people loitering, so they don't want the bench to be too comfortable. Everyone wants the bench to serve them and not the people that they don't like. Then you get to the worst part, politics. The city council is getting nonstop complaints about people sleeping on the old benches. You add an armrest so nobody can lay down on it, and suddenly you're designing for exclusion. After all that comes the really hard part. Manufacturing. In order for the client to approve this design, you need to prove that it can survive the heat, rain, graffiti, and some drunk guy drop kicking it at 2 a.m. And it's got to be easy to fix if it breaks, too. By this point, you're not even proud of your design anymore. The manufacturer gets back to you and they tell you it's going to cost $5,000 per bench. The press gets word of this and everyone on social media loses their minds. You're flooded with comments saying things like, "My tax dollars are paying for this. This is corruption. Who would ever approve such an ugly design?" And that's how the simple brief of make a nice park bench turns into a system where nobody is happy, especially the designer. And by the way, this is not exaggerated. San Francisco went through a very public version of this exact spiral with a trash can redesign. When you design anything, you're navigating an ecosystem of government regulations, geography, politics, procurement, and public scrutiny. And it's why we live in a world designed by the most terrified person in the room. A lot of people sent me this video, Why the World Got So Ugly, and I wanted to respond to it. I actually talked to this guy, and he seemed like a really decent person, so don't bombard him with mean comments or anything like that. Let's just focus on the ideas. But here's his framing.
These two lampposts don't just look different. They represent fundamentally different worldviews. If you want to understand any society, don't listen to what it says about itself. Look at what it creates.
Very true. Objects do reveal what we believe in, but what he's missing is that they reveal systems and power also. His next example is perfect. This insanely ornate Victorian sewage station.
Strange to think that this is infrastructure, and yet it has been designed with the same ornamental exuberance as any church or palace. That is how the Victorians thought.
It's a great shot and it's a great story, so I get why it lands. But the problem is, he's treating ornament as proof of care. Sometimes decoration signals craft and beauty, other times it's just Las Vegas tackiness. And you have to remember, during the Victorian era, there are reports of bathrooms literally exploding from flammable gases seeping up from the sewer system. Our modern sewers aren't as decorated, but its beauty is in the fact that your toilet doesn't blow up while you're pooping. So yes, you can learn a lot about what a society values based on what they design, but you need to dig beyond the superficial decoration. That old sewage station functioned as propaganda. It's what the Victorians wanted you to see. It doesn't show the way that most people actually lived during that time. It's sort of like an old car. Old cars can be a lot of fun. The roaring engine, the smell of gasoline, the lack of power steering is actually kind of a fun novelty. But the charm wears off really fast when you're about to get T-boned by a truck. I want modern brakes and crash safety standards so I have a better chance of surviving that collision. People from the Victorian era would happily trade their horses for our cars or their heavily decorated sewer system for a modern one that reliably doesn't kill them. The Victorian sewer would never work with today's demands and requirements.
These days, it seems that we would rather make more money to make things look pretty.
Look, I get why this lands. It's emotionally satisfying, but it's not telling the whole story. You can't just build a modern version of a heavily decorated Victorian sewer. It wouldn't pass modern safety standards. And believe me, it's a long list. Earthquake loads, fire egress, electrical code, ventilation, lighting, accessibility, slip resistance, handrail heights, emergency shutoffs, the list just goes on and on and on. Modern engineers and designers are not doing less than their Victorian counterparts while greedily hoarding profits. They're doing more, actually. It's just that most of the work is invisible. The beauty in modern design is that you don't notice it because you didn't suffocate or get electrocuted or catch on fire. This is one set of regulatory requirements for one category, for one country. And that's just electrical. There are entire libraries like this for dozens of other things. Some of this is bureaucratic BS, but a lot of it exists for good reason, which leads to the real aesthetic driver of the modern world, reducing risk. And this is why the world is designed by the most terrified person in the room. It's that person's job to prevent failure of the whole system. Now, to be fair, there are some cases where you can slap traditional styling onto modern systems, but it usually just feels off. More on that later, though. But anyway, he goes on to say this.
That we have become a society of convenience above all else.
I agree with this. It is true that we've prioritized cost and convenience as a society. I've been complaining about this for years.
Convenience.
But is that because we're obsessed with convenience and we're lazy? Is it because corporate oligarchs hate us? That story feels right, but it's incomplete. The job for contemporary designers has been to provide modern amenities to billions of people. Housing, appliances, electronics. This needs to happen at an insane industrial speed without accidentally killing people or collapsing the economy. You end up with systems that can be manufactured, installed, and maintained over and over again. Convenience is what happens when you try to run a country like a Costco. So to do that, designers and architects began to use standardization whenever possible. They'll use prefabricated structures like precast concrete rather than hiring skilled stonemasons. If it's faster to assemble concrete panels than to hire a stonemason, cities will eventually contain more concrete panels. You get a shift towards industrial repeatability. But this isn't because of laziness or indifference, at least not entirely. You need that repeatability because that's what keeps the machine running. I'm not saying I agree with this, by the way. I actually hate a lot of it. I'm just saying that this is one reason why the modern world looks the way it does. Policymakers try to control this rapid growth by imposing safety and regulatory standards. So as a designer, the fastest solution is to reference designs that have already been approved by regulators and are proven to be manufacturable at low costs. Anytime you scale something up quickly, it invites regulation. Regulation creates copying, and copying leads to the same proven designs being made by everyone and applied everywhere. Prior to this, designers had no option but to use local materials and tools and knowledge. Rome looked like Rome, Bali looked like Bali, Marrakesh looked like Marrakesh. The brutal truth is that in the modern world, the safest design is a copied design. Why invest millions in designing a building or a product only to have it become a liability nightmare or miss cost targets? This is a design style that's determined by lawyers and regulators just as much as it is by designers. They are the people who help decide what the system will allow and what it will punish. This is why good designers study policy and regulations. If you want to create something new, you have to understand what the system will allow. But even if you try something new inside those constraints, you might still pay for it. So you have two choices: get mad that the world rewards copying, or build yourself a workflow that stays flexible anyway. That's why I've been using AnyDesk and why they're sponsoring today's video. If you're a designer, creative, or editor working across multiple devices, AnyDesk might be the best tool you're not using yet. I've been integrating it into my workflow, and it's kind of a game changer. With AnyDesk, I can remotely access my editing rig from my laptop. The connection is so fast and responsive, it feels like I'm right there in my office. And it works on Windows, macOS, and all these other platforms. And because AnyDesk uses a proprietary codec, the image quality stays sharp, even in remote areas or on spotty Wi-Fi. Audio pass-through means I can scrub and edit YouTube videos remotely, and thanks to 99.98% uptime, I know I can rely on it. The direct file transfers are also really useful. No more cloud uploading, no more waiting to sync. I can move raw footage, project files, whatever I need, straight from device to device instantly and securely. If your workflow lives across many devices or locations, AnyDesk brings it all together seamlessly. It's free for personal use, and if you've got a team, they offer tailored business plans. Thanks to AnyDesk for sponsoring this video. Download AnyDesk for free today using my link in the description below. Back to the video. Cars started getting more puffy in the early 2000s. Some of that was aesthetic choice, but a lot of it was driven by more strict crash and pedestrian safety requirements. So we ended up with these inflated cars to protect drivers and pedestrians in a collision. In 2001, Chris Bangle, the head of design at BMW at the time, took a risk with the 7 Series. His team redesigned the trunk to have this extra shelf, like it got a Brazilian butt lift. Bangle told the New York Times that a new generation of engines required larger radiators, so the hood of the car needed to be higher. Driver sightlines shifted, and aerodynamic efficiency demanded the rear deck be reshaped in order to improve fuel economy. The press immediately mocked the design, calling it the Bangle Butt. Decades later, car enthusiasts still make fun of it. If you want a perfect case study in how the world punishes deviation, this is it. The Bangle Butt is what happens when a designer tries to introduce a new visual design inside a world that rewards predictable compliance. Even if laws don't explicitly punish you for trying something different, the culture often will. And even when designers aren't literally copying, they're using the same materials, the same tools, the same suppliers, and they're following the same regulatory playbook. They're all being educated in the same way too. So it's really not that surprising that things start looking the same. Like I said, the goal of modernism was to make the most important things available cheaply for everyone. And in that way, it was successful. We lost a lot of cultural diversity in that process, and I do hate that. But it's important to understand the reason why this happened, rather than just saying, oh, it's just laziness, or oh, they're just after money. That is directionally true, but if we want to fix the ugliness problem, we need to understand the whole story. It's also important to remember that it's not like things were much better before. People have always complained about their current times being ugly. H.L. Mencken said that America had a love of ugliness for its own sake, the lust to make the world intolerable. He wrote that in 1926. You probably think he's talking about a city that looks like this, but he was actually describing this. Now, to be fair, this was a coal mining town, so I'm sure there were some really horrible working conditions and other awful things going on. But at least when it comes to the architecture, today we'd call this kind of charming. So that's the first trap. Ugly often just means recent. In 100 years' time, many of the ugly designs of today might be viewed with nostalgic admiration, but we'll come back to that later. Next up is a second trap that everyone reaches for.
Decoration is so much cheaper than every other part of a building, right? You just gotta stick some pretty stuff on the front of it.
Slapping some decoration on top of a careless system won't make it beautiful. Trump's interior design team learned this the hard way. They took some filigreed molding and put it in the Oval Office. Things went really off the rails when it was discovered that a bunch of it was actually $50 mass-produced plastic pieces that anyone can buy at Home Depot. And I'm pretty sure they just spray-painted it all gold. Like I said, the objects we make are a reflection of our culture. Beauty is integrity. It's about intentional materials, proportions, craftsmanship, and a story you can feel, even if you can't quite articulate it. When a design is rushed and cheap, decoration can actually feel tacky because it highlights the mismatch. The reason why we love old things is because they have a story and a heritage. It's not really about decoration. Plus, even purely decorative elements have functional consequences. You have to think about how it's going to be fabricated, how it's going to be assembled, what it conveys, and who will design it. And these are extremely energy-intensive processes with very dangerous factory working conditions. It's only cheap if you ignore who has to pay for it. And then there's the expense of eternal maintenance. Every facade detail requires repainting, repair, and replacement. When infrastructure has to operate continuously at massive scale with minimal failure, decoration becomes a liability. I absolutely hate a lot of things about this system, but slapping decoration on things doesn't make the design better. There are solutions, but this is not it. It's not even true that there's no decoration in modern design. Some of the most decorative designs we make today are also the most hated. For example, McMansions, they're basically the housing equivalent of fast food. It's got huge portion sizes made with cheap ingredients and lots of flash trying to convince you it's something that it isn't. They've got design elements from completely different, unrelated time periods and cultures, and they're all thoughtlessly just mashed together. If a design doesn't consider the broader cultural context, it just feels confused and incoherent. It's like putting a tail fin from a 1950s Cadillac onto a modern Cadillac Escalade. The old tail fin is beautiful in its own context, but it's from a different time period. You can't just transplant a style and expect it to resonate in today's world. But there are other ways to express beauty aside from excessive decoration. Check out this church in Seattle. It's an ultra-minimalist design that honestly wasn't really my style at first glance. But then a priest pointed out a beautiful detail to me. At the right time of year, during the right time of day, with enough sunlight, you see some absolutely stunning shadows cast onto the sparsely decorated walls. You get bands of multicolored lights that shift and move through the year and throughout the day. I'm not particularly religious, but it's hard not to read that as a metaphor. Faith is something that transforms slowly over the years. The walls are completely bare, but the beauty is showing that quiet transformation with light. And this is the bigger point for objects, too. Sometimes beauty is revealed through quiet curiosity. The building isn't detailed in the traditional sense, but it's deeply considered. It's a clever way to create meaning while still playing inside modern realities. I generally hate minimalist design when it's done as a way to thoughtlessly cut costs, which is pretty common. But I do appreciate this church because it's a clever way to express beauty honestly, using the cultural context and constraints that we actually live inside now. We love old things because we're mortal. So when we see something old, we respect it because we know we'll never be able to sustain that time span and witness the world that this object has seen. We love old things because they outlive us. People have been complaining about new things being ugly for all of recorded history. There was a time when Gothic architecture was considered the height of barbaric ugliness, but we consider it beautiful today. In fact, the word Gothic was almost like a slur. To call someone's design Gothic was extremely insulting. It would be like someone calling something mid today, or even worse, chopped. Bro, that cathedral is straight chopped, dude. The bigger point is that tastes change, and that takes us to the real trap in this whole conversation. Nostalgia. The reality is we heavily idealize the past. When we look at a beautiful old lamppost, we forget about the fact that the streets in many Victorian era cities were literally covered in a thick layer of horse shit. The past fosters depression and nostalgia, the future causes anxiety, and modern minds seldom have the time to really live in the moment. So there's this move to brand the past as a more promising future, but this can get really dangerous. This return to more traditional aesthetics isn't neutral, and it isn't just about style. It often smuggles in a whole worldview about hierarchy and purity. The Victorian era wasn't some morally righteous time where everyone took pride in beauty. It was a time of rigid class systems, brutal labor conditions, rampant diseases, extreme wealth concentration, all set against a backdrop of rapid industrialization and political corruption. So when someone points at a gorgeous Victorian object and says, "See, they cared," it's a gross oversimplification. We see the beauty, but we forget about the costs.
I found that as soon as I started writing about it, people have all these connotations based on whether they think they're left-wing or right-wing. People think to criticize modernism, right, so like modern architecture, to criticize that must mean that you're somehow like a traditionalist, conservative, even a fascist. And then people also think if you defend modern architecture, the conservatives think you're like a radical socialist or a communist. And all of this is it's complete nonsense. It's just not true. I want to demolish these misguided political associations around the issue and establish a consensus.
I actually agree with the spirit of that. I think the party labels can do more harm than good. But here's the problem. You cannot take politics out of design, and I can prove it to you right now. What does this building represent to you? What about this one? And what about this monument? What about this uniform? This symbol? These designed objects all present an explicitly political point of view. They all exist in a cultural context, and they are not neutral. Whether we recognize it or not, every major political movement has an aesthetic. Even fonts project a certain idea or image. Whether intentional or not, political movements end up with a shared visual language that tells you what the movement values and who it's for. Every major political ideology presents an aesthetic point of view. Every single one. In the US, there have been actual executive orders to steer federal architecture towards classical styles. And look, I get it. Public buildings should be carefully designed, but making federal architecture beautiful again makes me wonder, beautiful according to who? The real conversation is less about traditional versus modern, and more about who should have the power to decide what good design is. We need to be careful about that, because this isn't just grandiose monuments either. Design is political even on a smaller scale and in more subtle ways. If you're designing a government website, you don't get to just use nice colors. You have to hit accessibility requirements for people with vision impairment. If you're designing a lamp, you need components that meet legal safety standards so it doesn't burn someone's house down. even when designers aren't trying to make a political statement, the system forces a point of view through laws and policy. The Crossnest sewer station was designed with the exuberant ornamentation of a cathedral because its makers were saying, look how advanced and powerful we are with our cutting-edge technological marvels. It was designed to show the power of the mighty British Empire. All political movements do this to varying degrees. So this story that we used to build cathedrals and now we build sterile boxes is very myopic. Once you frame the past as pure and beautiful and the present as degenerate and ugly, you've created a doorway for some very ignorant ideologies. In the harmless version, it's just decorating lampposts and sewers, that's fine. But in the toxic version, it discusses a need to return to tradition and order. These images of traditionalist iconography are appropriated by far-right political factions in order to further their worldview. They talk about returning to the glory of a romanticized and incoherent version of the past. They'll say that the degeneracy of modern life is rotting Western civilization while ignoring the insane injustices of the past. And this ideology often comes packaged with a very specific idea of who belongs in that return and who doesn't. Now, I want to be very clear here. I talked to Sheehan Quirk, the guy in that video. I really don't think he's some kind of far-right fascist. And liking traditional architecture doesn't make you one either. I like a lot of traditional architecture. Obviously, that's ridiculous. I'm also not saying that every video about ugly minimalist design is secretly fascist propaganda. I personally have criticized minimalism and convenience culture for years now. The point is that aesthetic debates are never just about aesthetics. They're arguments about what we value and who has the power. If you ignore this system, you'll keep misdiagnosing the problem. So we should be careful about the story we tell alongside traditional beauty, because these stories don't just stop at design. A few people I've spoken to about this have brought up the town of Poundbury. It's a modern town that's built with a traditional aesthetic. And honestly, there are a lot of things I really like about this place. There are serious attempts to mix zoning where shops are blended with houses. This allows for people to run into each other more often and form communities and friendships organically. A large portion of the houses are reserved for people with lower income, and they mix that housing with the rest of the town, so those people aren't ostracized and isolated like they would be in other low-income housing projects. I also really like that there's a sincere effort to make the town more walkable. But the thing is, none of those positive aspects require a traditional aesthetic. The same things could be achieved with good city planning and better zoning laws and just designing something thoughtfully. Plus, there are other major problems with this approach. The design is backed by the King of England and enforced by a master planner with very strict design codes. Everything from the color of front doors to the materials of gutters has to be approved. I wouldn't say it's ugly, but everything feels slightly eerie and staged. Traditional facades are built over modern building codes, so the proportions often look a little bit strange, almost like the McMansions I showed you before. One thing you'll hear is that the houses in Poundbury tend to appreciate and value faster than other more modern designs, but once again, I think a lot of that has to do with the city planning. And even if it is purely about the traditional aesthetics, you can't get it at scale without paying for it somewhere. In this case, you sacrifice affordability, speed, and who gets to decide the style. Do we want a king and some master planner deciding what your town is allowed to look like, down to the color of your gutters? I personally don't. But really, the deeper issue with nostalgic design is that it offers yesterday's answers to today's problems. We can look to the past for inspiration, but we can never really go back. We can't ignore safety, labor inequality, disability access, or the reality that we're all connected to each other in a way that our ancestors could conveniently ignore. Modern life creates modern responsibilities, and the new world has to carry that weight. You'll often hear people say that modernity is ripping apart the fabric of society, and honestly, they're not wrong. As Alfred North Whitehead put it, the major advances in civilization are processes that all but wreck the societies in which they occur. He said that 100 years ago, so this is nothing new. The fear of advancement has been going on since the dawn of civilization. We cling to the old world because it feels familiar and safe, but every major technological jump does two things at once. It moves society and culture forward, but it also uproots and destroys the old ways of doing things. The solution isn't to go backwards. The solution is to honor our past and learn from it so we can find a way to move forward. A lot of this return to tradition is comforting and emotionally satisfying because it gives you a clear story. We used to be coherent and beautiful, now we're chaotic and ugly. In The Medium is the message Marshall McLuhan wrote, "Innumerable confusions and a profound feeling of despair invariably emerge in periods of great technological and cultural transitions. Our age of anxiety is, in great part, the result of trying to do today's job with yesterday's concepts." McLuhan wrote this in 1967, but this is one truth that has remained constant, even today. We have to be suspicious of any story that says the answer is to simply go backwards. We can never go back. All we can do is build something new out of the wreckage. So what makes something beautiful? It has nothing to do with decoration or tradition. It's about care. Care is the only ingredient you can't fake. You can't mandate it with a checklist. You can't value engineer it into existence. You can't find it copying an old facade. Care is the decision to treat the ordinary objects in our lives as if they matter, because the people who use them do. You don't always see care. Sometimes care looks like a hand-carved stone sculpture. Other times it looks like a boring handrail that quietly guides you down a subway station staircase. If you take the time to slow down and look for it, you can feel the human spirit inside these objects that surround us. And I think that's what all of this arguing is really about. When people say the world is ugly, half the time what they mean is the world feels indifferent, like nobody's steering, like nothing is loved. We're surrounded by decisions made by people who will never have to live with them. I think what we all really want is a world where more things are made with the quiet message, "You matter enough for me to try." So if you take one thing from this video, let it be that. Don't romanticize the past. Don't demonize the present. Just demand care. These videos take hundreds of hours to make. I read 1,000 pages of articles and books. I talk to industry experts, and I reflect on my 15 years of experience in the design industry. I care very deeply about the things that I discuss here. And if you do too, you might consider supporting me on Patreon. You can sign up for a few dollars a month, and as a show of thanks, you get early access to my videos, plus a behind-the-scenes commentary video. I want to give a huge shout out to my patrons on Patreon. I sincerely appreciate your support. I couldn't do this without you. I hope you learned something, and have a great day.